Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is another normal episode. My guest this time is Rae Alston, and we are going to be discussing The Stress of Her Regard by Tim Powers, which is a 1989 novel that was nominated for the Locus and the World Fantasy Award, and which won a 1990 Mythopoeic Award. So hi there, Rae. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Seth. I'm really excited to be part of this and to discuss this really interesting book.
Yeah. And you're a friend of Paul Williams, is that right?
I am, yeah. We're best friends. We were college roommates, stayed up late, talking about books all the time. He's done two with you, right? Or just one?
Yeah. He's done two.
And I enjoyed listening to those, and he suggested, hey, why don't you try this out? See if Seth takes it up. So
Nice. Now, did one of you introduce the other to Tim Powers?
Yes. Paul introduced me to Tim Powers. And I'm trying to remember if he had actually read him yet, or if he just thought that it seemed like a good idea.
I think he mentioned it on the last episode that he threw a book at you that he hadn't read yet. Now that rings true. Yeah. But was like, I think he'll
like
this.
That's right, because he did a good podcast with you on Declare, which is an excellent novel. But yeah, I did read that first.
Yeah. So on my big list of award winners that people choose from, I think I do have the Mythopoeic Awards on there. And I usually the first time we cover something that is a winner, I like to at least mention what the awards are. So they were established in 1971 by the Mythopoeic Society. And the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award is given for fiction in the spirit of the Inklings. So that's Tolkien, Lewis, that group. It doesn't look like they do a single award every year. They award multiple books, but still, it counts. It's a winner. It's on the list. So it's just a regular old episode. So I know you're a friend of Paul's, but what else should people know about you?
Well, I've been trying to figure out where to start. Like I said, met Paul back at college. We were roommates at BYU-Idaho, studied English there, minored in Russian. Then I did some graduate work in Russian, master's and PhD for Russian literature, specialized in a lot of 19th century stuff. And I've been kind of a career doldrums for the last 5 years, haven't taught since 2020, but that's finally at an end. It's a huge blessing. I'm going to be a visiting professor at BYU-Idaho this coming fall semester. I'm so excited, feel so blessed and humbled to have that opportunity coming up.
Where is BYU-Idaho?
Rexburg.
I do not recognize that. What part of Idaho is that?
I mean, it's like 45 minutes north of Idaho Falls. So it's not that far from Utah. I it's going to be a 3-hour drive, for which I'm very thankful, because my kids would not be that excited about being in the car.
Yeah. All right. So let's go ahead and move into why this book.
I really enjoy Tim Powers. I read Declare before this, thought it was really quite a good novel. And Paul was telling me about that he has done all of these different novels about 19th century poets, which I really like. And I thought, you know, I like Tim Powers. I like the fun, zany fantasy stuff he's doing. I really like 19th century poetry. So it sounds like these novels could be like hitting both sides of my nerdhood. Mm. And so I thought I would give it a try.
Okay, nice. So, I mean, that's kind of like with Declare, if you like sort of secret history stuff and, mystical, spiritual things and a spy novel, that's a good
one. Right.
So just how about we do, like, in these episodes, post kind of finishing the list, the original list of Hugo winners, I'd like to get more quickly into the spoiler section just so we can talk about whatever. But let's go ahead and start with the little non-spoilerish as we can go discussion. So you want to kick that off with, like, what is this book about?
This book is about a man named Michael Crawford, and I'm trying to decide how much detail to give, but he is going into another marriage, trying to give himself a new start in life. But before that, he puts the wedding ring on a statue. And when he goes to get the ring back from the statue, the hand is closed as a fist and he can't get it. But he goes up through with the wedding, and the day after his wedding night, he wakes up and his bride has been brutally murdered and he has been accused. And so he goes and runs because there's no other way to clear his name. He's a fugitive, And while he is trying to escape, he discovers that in putting the ring on the finger of the statue, he has married a supernatural being that took the form of the statue, and she now considers him his bride. So he is now trying to figure out how to navigate that situation. At first, he kind of allows it, just kind of rolls with it, lets it be, and then he realizes that that's not going to work. He meets up with the famous poets Percy Shelley and George Gordon, Lord Byron, and they reveal to him that they also have relationships with supernatural beings, and Byron takes them on a quest to try to free themselves. There's some success, some failure. His sister-in-law, who is, that wife who was murdered, her name is Josephine. She is trying to get revenge for her sister's death. She comes chasing after him, ends up making her own supernatural deals at different points along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, lots of twists and turns there. He ends up in a relationship with her later on. They free themselves and then get sucked back into these weird relationships with these horrible supernatural entities.
Yeah.
And the main character takes a great deal of physical punishment.
He sure does.
I want to talk about that.
Yeah, he does. And like you mentioned, right, this is a secret history novel, kind of like Declare.
Right.
Where it sort of explains some of the lives and deaths even of some of those romantic poets. John Keats is another that he crosses paths with. I think that's the first person he actually meets, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, just a really interesting kind of notion of the cost of creativity and art output.
Which I thought that was an interesting topic. That was one of the things I put in my notes that I wanted to talk about, is for a creative writer, it's interesting to present other creative writers as working under the influence of these evil supernatural beings.
Right.
Right. And their creativity is also very destructive to the people around them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of, I grew up in the height of the Satanic Panic and, hearing that, well, the only reason Stephen King's so prolific is that he's got a demon, a demon helps him with his writing.
Did they really say that?
Oh yeah. Oh, 100%. In all seriousness, and people like Bob Larson, people who grew up in the '80s in the evangelical church will know who I'm talking about. There was a demon behind every bush and, anything that was remotely, heavy metal or horror novels or horror movies, it was all suspicious in Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah. But it's like he kind of diminishes their work in a way.
He does, because they can't take credit for it. And they do address that issue too. They're actually very sensitive about that question. Do you remember early in the novel when he asks Keats about it? Keats is like, no, my poetry is all mine. But it's pretty clear that it's not.
Right.
And the other, I'm wondering if there is kind of a play, because this is what, during the time, there were people who were calling Shelley and Byron part of the satanic school of poetry. And I'm wondering if this is a play on that, because have you read Anubis Gates by?
No, Powers? I haven't gotten to that one yet.
It's good. It's not quite as good as this or Declare, but it's really zany. There's lots of fun magic stuff. Coleridge is in that novel, and Coleridge is apparently not under the influence of evil spirits, but that makes sense in the logic of the era, because they called Coleridge part of the angelic school of romanticism. Mm. So I wonder if there's this play with those ideas that were part of the critical dialogue of that era.
Mm. Well, Shelley, I think, was kind of an out atheist at the time, right?
Right.
Which was not super popular in Christian Europe.
Certainly. Right. And they were both, and Byron was not, it's debatable. His relationship with Christianity is complicated because he had a very, Calvinist upbringing that it seems to me he was never able to completely shake. But at the same time, he was also very jaded by it. He had a lot of sexual abuse in his history. Some of that is addressed here. They talk about the one lord who, the other nobleman who sexually abused him. Apparently, according to this novel, he is one of these supernatural entities. Mm. But they didn't mention the nurse who watched him and sexually abused him, and she was also just very devout Calvinist Christian, and that, of course, really Kurt Byron, and he always had that association. But you see this, he's one of the romantics who presents the devil in a rather positive light, or satanic characters, broadly speaking. You've got Manfred, you've got his Cain as well, dramatic poem. So he's, both of these are, this is the more subversive side of romantic poetry, you know, Percy with his promoting atheism or just step outside of orthodoxy, and Byron with this rather subversive presentation. And so I think there is a logic to having them be the ones.
I might have to get some recommendations for you on what to read, just because I have not read much of the romantic poets.
I would like to read more of the English ones. Shelley especially, I've only recently been able to get more of an appreciation for him. I mean, everybody has read Ozymandias, but there's a lot of other good stuff that I want to get into. For Byron, Byron is an interesting poet. He was really popular back in that day. Everybody was reading him. And in Russia, everybody was reading him, which is a huge accomplishment. You know, since I've studied Russian Romanticism, Byron was a huge influence there. But with him, some of the stuff hasn't aged as well. Some of it seems a little glib. But I would go with Don Juan, which that's how he pronounced it, not Don Juan. It was Don Juan, and you have to say it that way for the rhymes to work. it's really clever. It's really interesting. These adventures of, he's not really a Don Juan in the strict sense, because he's not really a seducer. He's kind of just haplessly falling from one situation to another, and there are women who happen to be falling in love with him. But there's a lot of social satire as he's going through it. Pretty interesting. I haven't read the whole thing. It's huge, but I've read selections.
So let's move into kind of just some quick overall thoughts about the book before we get too deep into spoilers. You know, what is this, a reread for you, or is this a first time read?
This is the first time.
Okay.
How about you?
First time as well. I had never read Tim Powers prior to Declare. I did buy a couple of his books on Audible when I had a bunch of credits to burn. So I think I have the Anubis Gates. So one of these days I'll get into that.
With your time, how would you compare this to Declare?
So I felt like I enjoyed this one. It wasn't as much my thing as Declare, because Declare had that spy thriller element to it that I really, really got into. Where with this one, it was a little wordy in places. There were several times where I was like, oh, okay, this thing's starting to wrap up. And then I'd look down at my player on either in the, I was reading the book. In the book, you know, you're not going to be fooled by that. But on audio, it's pretty easy to get pulled into, oh, okay, we're moving to a close here. And like, nope, we've got 6 hours left. And so they were kind of, it's like it was faking towards, we're gonna do this thing, and this is gonna be the thing that is gonna help us win, and then we'll be done. Everything will be happy ever after that. I think I admire the book more than I like it, but I did enjoy it.
Yeah, I thought I saw a lot of Declare, especially in the first half of the novel.
Yes,
I felt like the journey into the Alps and stuff. I felt like, in many ways, that was kind of a first draft of the Ararat scenes.
Yeah,
in Declare. Did you get any of that?
I did. Yeah, and I will say, Tim Powers really knows how to start a novel. Both, at least so far, two for two with Declare. That first chapter really sucks you in, and the same thing here, where it's just, you know, Shelley and Byron on a boat in Switzerland, in a lake, and then something comes after them and they're able to repel it. And you're like, what is going on? And then it goes straight from there to the whole, you know, the muddy, murky night where he accidentally marries the statue.
It is a wonderful beginning. And I wanted to talk about that beginning because I think it's interesting that he starts us in this familiar territory.
Yes.
For readers. Even if you're not an expert in Shelley and Byron or in Romanticism, when you think Shelley and Byron in Switzerland, what's the first thing you think
of? Yeah, Frankenstein. Yeah.
Yeah, Frankenstein. They sitting around telling ghost stories to each other. And Tim Powers was smart enough, let's start with that. There's real ghosts.
Right, right. Well, yeah, and also it's that setting, but we don't really hear anything else about Frankenstein for 300 pages.
Yeah, exactly, for 300 pages. Then he brings it back and, yeah, it ties it back in. But I thought this was a smart beginning because it gets us in this familiar territory. We're expecting it, but then it puts that turn on it where, oh my gosh, but the ghosts are real this time. It's not just a story. What if there really was encounters with the supernatural? What a fun beginning. Yeah. So the statue with the ring, if you study Romanticism, are you familiar with the French writer Mérimée? I don't speak any French.
Mm, I don't think so.
So Prosper Mérimée, that's how an Anglo would say it. I don't know how the French would say it. But in 1837, he published a story called The Venus of Ile, I think is how you say the last part, The Venus of Ile. And this story is drawing on ancient folklore. But that story, there's a statue that a character is obsessed with, a statue of Venus, and he's obsessed with it, keeps talking about it, and he jokingly puts his wedding ring on that statue, and then he comes back to get it, and the hand is closed, and he can't get it back, and then he has his wedding, and the morning after his wedding night, they find him crushed by the statue.
Interesting.
So Powers is drawing from an existing tradition, not just in folklore, but specifically in Romanticism. This is the period, you know, this is later in the period than what he's portraying, but it's still from that period, and it's a recognizable story for those of us who are studying Romanticism. But he puts this really interesting turn on it. He wants us to recognize the story, but he changes it not just by having the bride killed, but he doesn't end the story with that. That's where he begins the story.
Right.
And so it's not just this supernatural punchline at the end where it's a one punch story, sort of like a, trying to think like Twilight Zone sort of thing, but it begins where that story ends, where you're thinking about what would be the consequences of somebody who had this happen. And I thought that was a really productive way to engage with this pre-existing tradition, is to start with the ending and think, what are the consequences?
I admire that, you know, obviously in something like this, there's something super arcane going on, right? And who understands this, right? And so it takes Crawford a long time to figure out what happened, because he's thinking back on that night. And he's like, well, I remember all the, you know, the fun wedding night stuff that I was thinking was going to happen. And then later on, he's like, I'm not sure that was happening with my wife, though.
Right. Wait a second.
Yeah.
The supernatural stuff is pretty spooky in this book too.
It is. And it's, you know, it mixes up some of the kind of lore. You could very easily see that the existence of these creatures would spin off into folklore about vampires and about the succubus, and incubus and, you know, all kinds of other things.
I count it. Let's see. Vampire, succubus, incubus, Nephilim.
Lamia. I'm
trying to think.
Lamia.
Lamia is the other. Lamia is the big one from the, because of Keats. And then they even call them muses.
Yeah. And the gray eye as well.
Oh, I didn't remember that one.
Yeah. That's the reference to the eyeball, right? Where that's big spoilers, but we can kind of get back to that. I mean, I think before we move into spoilers, you know, as much as I'm saying, it's not something that, is necessarily my style. I think it's a well-executed novel. If you like, you know, if it's the kind of, if it sounds like the kind of thing that you'd like, you're going to be in it for a while. It's a pretty thick book.
Yeah, it's pretty thick. And there's a lot to recommend it. And it really spoke to me. Part of that is, like I said, it hits both sides of my nerddom. I like the fantasy and I like the poets. So if you're a reader of these poets, there's a lot of fun Easter eggs in this book. And a lot of fun hints, like still at the beginning of the novel, the first time he meets Keats, Keats talks about how these creatures, Lamia, succubi, whatever you want to call them, they are extending his life.
Right.
What is the first thing you know about Keats?
I don't know anything about Keats, I have to admit.
Okay. Sorry, didn't realize that. So, I mean, Keats is one of the major poets of English Romanticism, but he died in his early 20s.
Okay.
And so if you hear Keats talk, and you know that Keats died of consumption, tuberculosis, whatever you want to call it, in his early 20s, and then you see, oh my gosh, these things are extending his life, you know that something's not right here.
Yeah.
What's gonna shorten his life if these creatures are extending it?
Oh, nice. I'm gonna save that for spoilers. Let's say we flip the switch and just say, okay, all spoilers from here. You good?
No, I'm good.
Okay. So I think it's funny that we haven't even mentioned Polidori because the role that he plays in the book, you know, he's always the Polidori was also there at this famous,
yes,
you know, stormy night, right? Where we're supposed to write, right, a ghost story. And he wrote The Vampire, which is good. I enjoyed it. I read it a couple of years ago, but he's sort of always the also ran of that group.
Right.
And here he's kind of always in the background and always kind of like a hanger on.
Yes.
And sure that Byron was deliberate.
Just like boots him out when Michael Crawford shows up, like, oh, yeah, now he's my physician. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah. So Crawford ends up running, right? I don't think he was ever actually accused before he ran, right? He realizes, I've woken up in a bed with a woman who has been smashed to bits, right? There's no way I could have actually done this, but who's going to listen to me? I'm covered in gore. And so it doesn't seem that it should be possible for me to do this, but I've got to run. And so he ends up running. I think they're in Scotland at the time, where the novel kind of begins after the cold open. And so he ends up fleeing to, you know, more of the south of England and changing his name just slightly and working as, I think, a veterinarian at some point and then as a physician as well.
Yes.
And that's when, you know, you kind of have Josephine coming along to push him out of wherever he is because they seem to keep crossing paths again.
Yes.
Did you get the impression, was it explicit that Josephine is his wife's twin or just her sister?
I didn't notice if she was the twin. It seemed like there was an age difference.
Yeah, so I'm a little puzzled on that. At times I felt like it was definitely saying twin. I didn't go back and reread any of those passages. I went back a couple days ago and flipped through the book in print and just kind of reread key passages to kind of get them back in.
I'm not sure about that, but there is kind of this doubling and foiling going on with Josephine and the sister. What was the sister's name again? Can't even remember.
Josephine. Oh, Julia.
Julia. Yeah, that's right. Julia and Josephine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and there's something strange going on there where it seems like she's not quite all there.
Yeah.
She might have a dissociative identity kind of syndrome.
Right. And sometimes she starts presenting herself as Julia.
And it could be just a coping mechanism. You find out that their growing up, their home life was not amazing, that there was a kind of a history of her pretending to be Julia and her sister laughing at her over it. So it's another interesting thing is that, like, I didn't know much about Percy Shelley, right? I didn't know about how he met his fate, but I thought it was interesting in that opening scene that it definitely mentions that he can't swim.
From the beginning.
Yeah, from the beginning. And they're pretty close to shore at some point. And he's like, sorry, I can't do it. I guess I'm dying out here. And that's really important for later.
Really important for later. And yeah, it's like the Keats extended life thing. Like, oh, you know, this is important because he's going to die a little.
Yeah.
Easter eggy int. And yeah, I don't think that qualifies as a spoiler, right? Talking about how the poets die. It seems like.
No, I don't think so.
Historic record, though. What he does with it is really interesting, and I will discuss that in greater detail once we switch over to spoilers.
Oh, no, we're in spoilers.
Oh, we are? Okay, good. One of my favorite things about this novel is what he does with the death of the poet. The way that he renders the poets while they're alive has some successes and some shortcomings. I personally, and Paul is disagreeing with me, he's working on the novel now, but I personally didn't love his portrayal of Shelley. I felt like Percy Shelley did a lot of info dumping. And for me, it just feels like we were talking about one of the dozen best poets in the English language. And if he's going to be info dumping, I would at least want it to be otherworldly, the way he was describing it. Maybe like more metaphorical, where he was like intuiting the way that these supernatural creatures were working. But we have him just kind of going through and really explaining detail by detail how the conceptual aspects of the novel work. And the concepts are very interesting.
Yeah.
Powers is a master at this sort of thing. Just the different aspects of lore that he's tying together, connections that you're like, I never would have thought to connect that. Now I'm never going to unsee that. But to have a Shelley who is lecturing about that, to me was a little disappointing. What were your thoughts on that, though?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue that his creativity didn't extend to his exposition.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
I think it's interesting, too, though, that, you know, it's not like one character gets all the exposition, because definitely Keats gives some of that as well. It reminded me a little bit of in Highlander, the series, you know, like when the immortals meet, they can sense each other. And so Keats almost immediately picks up on the fact that Michael is one of these, what do they call him, Nephesh or something?
Nephers.
Right, right. It reminded me of like the word nebbishy. like a Yiddish word, but yeah, can kind of recognize that there's somebody else like him. It's interesting too, because the it's kind of the cosmology of the book, and this is kind of going way to the end, right? Where you find out more about the origins of this, and Crawford starts to cotton to some of this when he's asked like the Sphinx question, you know, the riddle about right. What goes on 4 feet, then two, then three. And he gives an answer that's just on the edge of, you know, it's sort of intuitive, and like the different ways that these creatures can come to be.
Yeah.
Where it kind of mixes up vampires and other things.
Yeah, really interesting. I loved the bit. I did like, so I guess my complaint with Shelley is only when he's talking. The way that the story and stuff, the whole idea that he had this half-sister who is the supernatural being that was part of his body until he cut her out. Fascinating story. Mm-hmm. And then this is the very statue that Michael Crawford, and I can't get over the name, by the way. I wonder why he named him Michael Crawford. I keep thinking of the actor.
Yeah. Oh, from Condor Man, the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, Condor Man Phantom of the Opera is what I think of. And I kept singing Music of the Night.
Yeah.
Through this novel and stuff, which I guess is not inappropriate because these are, you know, creatures of the night, and it's part of this kind of gothic tradition.
Yeah, it shows you where my nerdery goes, that I went to Condor Man before Phantom of the Opera.
Spy novel.
Yeah, The Game of X. It's fun.
Yeah, but so yeah, I thought that was kind of funny, but I don't know that he's trying to do something with the name the way that like Dickens or J.K. Rowling does things with people's names. I'm not sure why he chose it, though.
Yeah, but like I was saying, you know, Keats is just the first person to kind of give him the exposition, and then Shelley does a lot of it as well. But then he meets, I can't remember the name of the old Frenchman, like where his French is wrong somehow.
Yeah, it's just really old French, you find out. This guy has been around for centuries. He's like medieval. Wasn't that Villon or?
Yeah, something like that. He goes by
more than one name, and I think both of those are poets, so the idea is that like it's the same guy but manifesting in different eras, I thought. I don't know the French literature nearly as well.
Yeah, where he's kind of come to, like, I've been around long enough, it's time for me to go, and actually tries to get Crawford to drown him, because that's one of the ways to separate them, because otherwise the Nephilim can come and save them.
Right, yeah, apparently the drowning is one way to get free. And that's important, of course, for Shelley, which for me, that was one of the that was maybe the high point of the book, was Shelley's deliverance there. But I loved what he did with the death of these poets, Keats and Shelley on screen, and then the implication about Byron.
Mm-hmm.
What it's interesting, it reminded me of, did you watch Doctor Who?
I've never really been a Whovian.
No, well, in the first season of the new version, like back in the 2000s, there's an episode called Father's Day where the companion of the doctor, her dad died in just a freak accident, but she goes back to try to save his life, but that opens up time to all of these horrible things. And so then her father decides that he will sacrifice himself to save the world from this horrible time catastrophe. And so his accidental death turns into this heroic death. It's a beautiful episode. It's a beautiful idea there. And that's a little bit of what Powers is doing here with the death of these poets, which is, if you're reading it without the secret history, it just looks like an accident of history. Tuberculosis for Keats, drowning for Shelley, Byron went off to fight for Greek independence and died of some disease there. And Powers takes this so that they are willingly sacrificing an extended life and this powerful creative powers given to them through these supernatural beings in order to save the people around them who are being negatively affected by their connection to the supernatural beings. And there's something so powerful about the way that works.
Yeah. Yeah, that reminds me a little bit of the in Star Trek The Next Generation, where you have Tasha Yar, who dies in this meaningless way. But then she comes back in a subsequent episode and is given a chance to sacrifice herself and make it more meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but that's the idea. So I thought it was interesting that you said that I didn't realize that the Mythopoeic Award is awarded for those in the tradition of Lewis and Tolkien. And my first thought with this novel would definitely not be Lewis and Tolkien.
No.
But there is a Christian element to it. And Crawford does have something of a Christian conversion in this. And it is partly influenced by the death of the poets. There's the moment where I'm going to open up to the novel because I think the passage is interesting. It's pretty late into the novel in my version. It's on page 368. They're going through a graveyard, and it said Crawford found himself praying to the weather-grayed little figures on the different graves and stuff. He wasn't precisely praying to Christ, but to all the gods who had represented humanity and had suffered for it. Curled around his mental image of the wooden Christ were vague ideas of Prometheus chained to the stone with the vulture tearing at his entrails, which actually also brings Shelley into it because he wrote a Prometheus Unbound,
right,
where he presents Prometheus as this heroic figure accepting the suffering on behalf of humanity. So Prometheus chained to the stone with the vulture tearing at his entrails and Balder nailed to the tree around the roots of which flowers grew where the drops of blood fell, and Osiris torn to pieces beside the Nile. So he has this kind of composite view of the suffering gods as the right ones that he is going to call on for deliverance from these other supernatural beings, or as an alternative to these. At one point, I think they refer to them as the old gods, or that's like the older manifestations.
Mm-hmm.
And so he sees the suffering gods as representing humanity. It's kind of this postmodern Christian conversion.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like the Jesus mythicist view, right? Where Jesus is just the latest in the this line of myths.
Right, and I'm saying postmodern because he's deciding to just roll with it and be converted to the story.
Yeah,
you know, whether or not in a positivistic sense there is something on the other side. But later in the novel, he does take the next leap and does have this like complete conversion to Christ, where it's not just this composite Jesus mythicist view. But I thought it's interesting that this is the process that he goes in, and I think the poets play a role in that because they choose to sacrifice their immortality, or at least their extended lives,
yeah,
for the sake of others around them. And this is, you know, similar to the Christ descent, what in theological terms we would call kenosis of Christ. And the poets are setting that pattern for him. And that's, interestingly, what stays with him for Shelley, more so than the things that he actually writes, is that Shelley and Keats were willing to lay down their lives in the end.
Yeah. The fact that the Lamia or Nephilim offer this creative, you know, kind of output to all these writers is interesting, that one of them chose Michael Crawford, a physician, to kind of become married to. Because, you know, when that scene first happens, right, he's just kind of stumbling through the dark, trying to help a friend, and realizes, oh crap, I've got this wedding ring. I can't lose this in the mud. We'll never find it. And then what happens at the wedding tomorrow? And oh, look, convenient statue. But of course, it wasn't a convenient statue. The statue was trying to lure him.
Yeah, apparently it was all set up.
But it's like the Lamia never really offers him that same thing that Byron and Keats have such a hard time separating from.
And that's true. They don't offer him that added benefit. Same with Polidori, actually. Polidori, when he ends up making the deal with the Lamia, he is deprived of poetic power, which is a bit of there's a bit of irony there, because that was what he was trying for the whole time. He's kind of this poetaster hanging on to the true poets.
Right, he's the Salieri, right, from Amadeus.
Exactly. Oh, I'm so glad you made that reference. I'm a huge fan of Amadeus. Yeah. And also, So while you're asking for recommendations, the Russian poet Alexander Pushkin wrote a one-act play called Mozart and Salieri in 1830. Mm. And Peter Schaeffer, who wrote Amadeus, insists that he didn't ever hear about it. I don't believe him because there are parts where Amadeus almost quotes Pushkin, but it's a terrific play, and I love Amadeus too. I don't mind that he plagiarized because what he did was terrific. Yes. I don't even know if it's plagiarism. Maybe it's almost like what Powers is doing in this novel. Mm-hmm. He took the theme and he's riffing on it. So he expands where Pushkin gives kind of this wonderful, compact, short play. Anyway, but yes, Polidori is the Salieri figure who, and there's the irony that he makes the deal with the devil for the poetic power, but he loses his soul and doesn't get what he wanted.
Right. He does not gain the whole world. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Did not gain his whole world, but he lost the soul anyway. It's a biting irony. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. There is the line, though, when you're talking about Crawford's relationship with that statue, Shelley is convinced that she married Crawford to get to him so that she could get to Shelley again. I feel like there was only that one comment about that, though. Did you feel like there's reason to give that idea credence?
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's there, and certainly there is a connection that's made there, and Crawford is very upset by it, right? Because even though he's, quote, divorced his wife, are they ever given names? I mean,
I don't think they are.
The ones that take over for dead people just take the names of, you know, like Polidori, right?
Polidori, right.
But there, it's really fascinating to me the trick Powers plays here without ever giving you a name for his wife. And I'm not talking about Julia. I'm talking about his you know, statue wife.
And there is a rich tradition in fantasy of the nameless ones being like this ultimate evil thing.
Well, I mean, even like the muses, right? Where they're in some sense not real, right? They're forces of nature, even though of course the muses have names. Although the way muse is typically deployed in, you know, colloquial terms is, you know, she's my muse, and you know, my wife is my muse, or you know, someone else,
right?
Where here it's like, I mean, you really have a muse who's nameless and behind the scenes, and only you really see.
And some of the shift in the usage comes from the shift in Romanticism, where before the Romantic Age, the term genius meant a tutelary spirit that gave you ideas, right? There, that's where the term evil genius means. That's equivalent to the devil, the shoulder devil. It's the evil spirit telling you stuff, which versus the good spirit telling you what to do. Those were external until the Romantic era. The Romantic era internalized that and said, no, this is coming from within the poet. This is the God within me, not the God without. Powers is saying, nope, they're wrong.
Yeah.
This is still external. He's re-externalizing what the Romantics had internalized. And so there is kind of this return to an archaic presentation there.
Mm. You know, Powers, I think, like one of his strengths is showing the encounters, these transcendent encounters kind of that happen. You know, in Declare, there's several of them. There's the Ararat one, the later Ararat one. There's several in there. And this one, you know, the encounter in the Alps where this is your first little hint that there's something about it. I read it as the atmosphere is thinner and somehow, you know, that it's not just the altitude. It's like we find out later there's something about the sun. And so maybe in the thinning atmosphere, it makes it even harder for them. And you have that kind of divorce that happens there. And that's when you first really encounter Josephine again. And it, like all those scenes where there's the encounters and the attempts to break the chain are really, really well done.
Really well done. Really fascinating. And he pulls from all of the folkloric stuff we know. Water is classic. Silver, garlic. Mm-hmm. Although popping a glass eye into your mouth and filled with garlic and chewing on it, inflicting wounds on yourself, and then come on,
and then making out with somebody.
That was something. Yeah, then making out with somebody. So you're both sharing. That was something else, man.
It was very evocative. Like I could practically taste the garlic.
Yeah, and I could feel the glass shards and taste the garlic. Like you said, it was remarkable. That for me, that was where the book really. Yeah. Once you get to the Keats death scene, everything before that, I felt like this feels like a first draft of Declare. And that was when it was really taken off for me, mm-hmm. is when he gets to those deaths of the poets, which I've talked about a little bit. And you also get just that weirdness. I guess that would work. Mm-hmm. But man, and we got to talk about all the physical punishment character takes. Have you ever read a novel where a character gets injured this much?
Boy. I don't know. I mean, he really does go through the ringer. At some point, like having been shot in the leg is just no big deal anymore.
Actually, that was one of the things. It makes it for kind of heavy reading sometimes, like between like all of the really messed up stuff from the Nephilim and then the physical punishment he's taking. This is a dark book. I think this is much darker than Declare. Hmm. As far as other characters who take this level of physical punishment, maybe Don Quixote, he sure gets beat up a lot, but he also tends to recover, and the wounds that finally lay him low are psychological rather than when he finds out that when he has to accept that this has been just a game and he can't be Don Quixote anymore. That's what crushes him rather than the physical punishment, but he does take a bit. Maybe Harry Dresden, but he's a wizard, so he keeps recovering from all of the physical punishment. He can do it supernaturally. Michael Crawford ends the book really like physically disabled.
Yeah.
Compared to where he was at the beginning.
I do want to talk about the very end, but yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, please. I thought that was an interesting and a very honest move to take because most authors give a way out of that level of physical injury, but he loses the use of an arm and a leg. Mm-hmm.
Several of his fingers, yeah.
Yes, several fingers. There's permanent damage going on here. And for me, that heightened all of this. You know, we talk about the suffering gods, and I think that's another thing that he needs there, is he's somebody who is experiencing all of this suffering. And it makes sense to me that kind of a character would cry out to the suffering gods for deliverance.
Yeah. I'm getting it mixed up as if it was in this book where doesn't he bite off one of his own fingers?
He does.
Yeah. All the lengths that he goes to repel the Lamia or the gin, you know, whatever they are, you know, with the garlic and the brandy and the self-inflicted wounds is really something.
Yeah.
And even in that scene with the glass eyeball, you know, when she pops that out of her skull and bites down on it, and then they have the kiss there. There's also the little, I reread it yesterday, just the little moment of when their heads come close together and he remembers the bullet that is under her skin because she's been shot in the head, but it was just a glancing blow and it stuck under her forehead.
She's really injured too, obviously. She lost the eye. She has the bullet wound. She has a lot of psychological trauma. And they have this pretty interesting relationship, I thought, where they keep coming together and separating and trying to figure out their relationship and free each other from the Lamia and sometimes give in to temptation from the Lamia and then try to figure out how to get back on the path. I thought it was a compelling relationship.
Yeah, I did too. I think when I talked about the book seeming a little long in places, it seemed like it was starting to wrap up and, you know, they're finally kind of on each other's sides and they've become lovers, I think. And they're kind of like, okay, this is our happily ever after that's going to happen. And then she goes off and has her own little dalliance with the Nephilim. And it just kind of reminded me of Dracula, you know, where
interesting
Mina has kind of gone out after Dracula.
Yeah. Interesting.
And it just kind of, it's like, it kicks the ball down the road a little bit. Keeps the thing going.
Yeah. It keeps the thing going. I feel like, for me, one of the other weaknesses of this novel, and maybe I don't know if it's that big of a weakness. Okay, so if you think about Declare, you have the stuff for the main character, Hale, and his relationships, but you also have this wider scope with the Cold War.
Yes.
Right? And this interesting stuff about the Soviet Union is actually being powered by supernatural entities. And someday I hope I can talk to you about the Russian cultural references with that, because he's actually doing a really good job with Russian culture there. Mm. But I feel like that Cold War stuff is pretty compelling. In stress of her regard, I didn't really care about the Habsburgs and the Carbonaris.
Right.
Did you care about that?
No, no. And in fact, as soon as you started talking about this, I thought, you know, the geopolitical situation is there in the background, but it's never developed enough for me to care about it.
I didn't care about it. I did care very much about Michael Crawford and Josephine mm-hmm. and them getting free from the Nephilim and the poets. I mm-hmm. wanted all of them to be free from the Nephilim. The geopolitics didn't care. And I don't think that's just because I'm a son of a Cold Warrior. I think it's also how Tim Powers is developing it. Do you get a similar sense?
Yeah, and I don't know. It seemed like that for as long a book as it was, I didn't really feel like it set the stage well for what exactly was going on between Austria and Italy.
Yeah.
I still enjoyed the confrontation at the end, right? Where you find out there's an even older guy who was the first guy to kind of crack this, right? And thousands, or like, I don't know, 1500 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And this is where you really get into the Nephilim idea that, and I like that some of it's kind of vague. It's like the sun changed. I'm like, well, what do you mean? It reminded me of like, in young Earth creationist theories, there's this theory of like the ice canopy or the vapor canopy that after right. the flood,
that
all of a sudden,
before the flood,
yeah, that now all of a sudden the sun beats down on the Earth at a higher rate, and there's a consequence of people don't live as long now because the sun is hard on people,
right?
And so it kind of reminded me of that like, and that's where you find out, right, that they kind of went dormant, and this guy figured out, maybe if I take one of them inside of me, I can be a bridge between the species.
And so he becomes the first villain defeated by Caesarian section.
Yes. Yeah. And this is where, like, this is the reason that Michael Crawford is a doctor, right? Because he's essentially an OBGYN. And so at some point earlier in the novel, he finds this picture and he's like, this isn't a Caesarian. This looks like it's putting something into a body.
Into it.
And that becomes important because he can remember that. So you have that very dicey scene where Josephine is now his assistant, you know, nurse, and they're performing an operation on someone in a very dangerous situation because he's kind of melded himself with the building and the stones in the building.
And Crawford himself is way broken at this point physically. So it is really dicey. That part worked for me. But I think this is one of the main reasons why he had Josephine go and make the deal with the Lamia in the 11th hour is to salvage the novel. We don't care enough about the geopolitics, so we've got to get it back on that personal level. So, you know, she's pregnant at this point, and he says if he's born, it's going to be like Shelley again, unless we come up with a way of deliverance. And so they... you know, defeating the villain is the way to save their family. And so I do care about that. Mm-hmm. And I think he does salvage that and it does pull it off. But for me, the high point is still the death of Shelley, where it's Shelley sacrificing his life. And at the same time, Crawford is sacrificing his connection to the Lamia and thus his potentially extended, possibly immortal life and any of the other benefits.
Yeah.
I wonder, so... in Powers, in both the Claire and here, there is this idea of like a false or an alternative salvation to what Christianity goes. Like in the Claire, there is the thistles that can make the tea that'll make you immortal.
Mm-hmm.
And Hale decides to turn away from that and finds faith. In this novel, there's the deal with the devil or the Lamia, which is the false salvation, which it's interesting because it reminds me of, I'm going back to Pushkin, another romantic poet. He has a poem where he actually says, I would give up the immortality of my soul to live forever in my poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little bit of what these characters are having to ask is, am I going to go for the Christian immortality or for like, Horatian immortality, like a monument built without hands sort of thing, like in the Odes of Horace, like classical or Greek immortality. Do we want to live forever in poetry or do we want the soul? Like the scripture you were alluding to before, right?
Yeah.
What does it profit you if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? And this is one of the things that he's working out in the novel is immortality through poetry or through this evil relationship versus the immortality of the soul, which you're still betting on it through faith because
Sure.
He's not giving you straight evidence of it in the novel. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think there you could read these novels and go, or read this novel and think, you know, the Nephilim aren't actually evil. They're just, you know, they're trying to live. It's just that people who get involved with them don't understand the cost. And so if there was a presentation of, here is the contract, you can't cheat on me, I will get very upset. and also, of course, you know, no secret marriages, right? that's right out, right? He didn't know he was marrying into this and what the consequence would be. Even though, of course, you do kind of find out that his marriage was kind of a marriage of convenience. A doctor of his standing should have a wife. You know, that doesn't mean that you want to fridge his wife right at the beginning there. But yeah, like I could see somebody kind of like when I watch Blade Runner, by the end, I'm kind of like, I mean, I kind of get where Roy Batty's coming from. You know, he just wants to live. And that's kind of the same with these creatures. And it's just that some of the kind of double dealing that happens and people not understanding the stakes is where it gets tricky.
They're so predatory is the other thing, though. I get your point. At the same time, they're just so predatory. Like Keats talks about how like all of his family is dropping dead from tuberculosis and it's all tied to this and his connection with them. You know, Shelley has children dying. Byron has children dying from it. They're losing people right and left. Their relationship with these people is this like vampiric, horrible, sexual, predatory stuff. It's dark and it makes them numb to the world. It makes them outcasts to society. And so I get your point that this is, you know, a lot of it's not having the contract revealed to them clearly, but man, what a deal. It's awful.
Like, oh yeah. It's not a good deal. I mean, no matter how you cut it, but if somebody went into it with, you know, their eyes completely open, then you know, whatever. But even so, like during that scene where Shelley is drowning and they've got the blood connection going with Shelley and Crawford, which is another very visceral thing to me when it kind of describes the, you know, the taste of blood. I hate it when people say coppery taste. I'm like, we all know what blood tastes like. Not all of us know what a penny tastes like. So just say it tastes like blood. Metallic, I get, but whatever. You know, when all that's happening, and of course the Lamia is pleading for her life and saying, wait, are you sure that you want to do this? You don't have to do this. Hey, here's an even better deal. What do I have to do to get you back into this relationship, right? I'm putting on the full used car salesman. Look, I'll exempt everybody you care about from it, and they'll all be safe. But then, like you said, the kind of predatory thing reveals itself a little bit is when that creature dies, she kind of shifts into a snake. And there's other times where they kind of shapeshift into lizard or serpent shapes.
That serpent with wings image is specifically what Keats uses in his long poem Lamia.
Okay. That's another fun part of this is for somebody who doesn't know these poets well, each chapter begins with just a little snippet from some of their work.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. I like it. It's a and it's very evocative, and it usually presents it in a different light where it's sometimes it's almost, I don't know. So I like that you can see them as metaphorical, but I'm not necessarily disappointed that he presents these lines in such a literal way. It's still fun play with it.
Well, it builds into the secret history thing, right? Now I know what they were really talking about.
Right. So it's a fun conceit. I do recommend Lamia by Keats. It's an interesting poem. Part of the interesting thing to me is the Lamia, this guy marries this girl who is actually this Lamia, this snake, and she keeps him trapped in this cave. So you do get the weird, you know, sort of predatory relationship. But then he finally convinces her to come to a party, and so he can show everybody who his wife is. And she finally gives in, and they go, and there's a philosopher there, and he sees her and says, wait, you're not really a human. You're a Lamia. And then when the pretense is up, she turns back into the Lamia, and the man who married her dies. Mm. And it's interesting. He's so crushed that the illusion is gone. And so the interesting thing about the poem is that Keats is writing it as this elegy for the illusion rather than, you know, an 18th century poet would present the philosopher as the hero. But in this poem, it's, and the interesting thing is that the Lamia is shown in a little bit like the creature from Frankenstein, where it is something that does trigger fear in the reader, but you also sympathize and empathize with the character, like the creature. And so I think Lamia is well worth your time. And they're different in this, though. I did not feel much sympathy for them. Maybe a little bit at the end when that statue, at the end of that statue's life, when she's pleading for her life and saying, I'll do anything. Maybe a little sympathy there. Otherwise, I mostly just saw them as predatory. Did you have much sympathy for those?
I mean,
in this book,
kind of what I hinted at, that you know, I can kind of see that, you know, they are another living creature. It's just the fact that, like you said, there is that predatory element to it that makes it. So you're like, I'm sorry, but this is what we're left with, right? We're trying to save the lives of people.
Yeah. I guess you're right. They are another living thing, and I can feel sympathy for a tiger even when I don't want to get eaten by one. So
sure. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that statue does say, I love you, when she's trying to save her life.
Yeah.
And later in the book, Crawford does realize, you know what? I think they actually do love us on some level.
Mm-hmm.
It's destructive, but I don't think they're insincere.
Right. Right. And, you know, it's a definitional thing. What does that mean to you that you love us? Yeah. Well, I think I've come to kind of the end of my notes, which I hastily put together this evening. But any kind of final thoughts about this novel?
This novel speaks to me. It's very dark. It's certainly not for the faint of heart. And it's certainly one that I am not going to be recommending to my kids until they are a bit older.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly speaks to me, and it is wholesome. You know, these are... We live in a world where there are predatory relationships, unfortunately. And so I think there is some necessity to bring that out in the open. And there is a lot of suffering in this book, but there's also suffering in our world. And to be able to go and find meaning in it, and even a particular Christian meaning, I thought it was very a moving book. And that passage in about the suffering gods has stuck with me. And so has, you know, those wonderful scenes with the death of these poets. So I highly recommend this. I think it's really interesting to see what he's doing with romanticism, with these poets. And I recommend the book.
Nice. And, you know, I also recommend the book, especially if you're a fan of Tim Powers and you haven't read this one. Like I said, I was sucked right in at the beginning of it, and read in print for a while, and then I kind of needed to make some progress on it and had some yard work to do, and so I took a lot of this in on a couple afternoons when I was doing a lot of weeding and lawn maintenance, and yeah, like from that very beginning scene where I'm like, oh, I know what this is, you know, I know what the Lake Geneva or whatever it is that, where they are, and it's an interesting trick that Tim Powers pulls in some of these secret histories. And like I said, he can really, really start a book. Read the first couple chapters.
He can really start a book.
Yeah.
It's really satisfying beginning. And I'm excited to read some more Powers. Have you heard of Hide Me Among the Graves?
Yes.
I guess Polidori comes back.
It's kind of a sequel to this one, right?
I guess loosely, because it's Polidori and more poets, not these ones. So that's going to be my next Powers, definitely. I love this, and I love what he's doing with 19th century poetry. So got to have more of it. Got to get that fix. And that'll be my next Powers. What about you?
All right. I mean, I have a couple of his other books, I think, on Audible. So at some point when I have a little more time, I'll probably get back to some of these. But yeah, I enjoy his work. You'll have to let me know what you think of the quote sequel.
Will do.
Cool.
Thanks for your time tonight, Seth. This was really a fun conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for doing this. I wanted to say thank you. And do you have anything you want to plug or anything that you got going on?
Not immediately. I'm trying to get a podcast started with a friend. We're calling it Expressions, Faith, and Art.
Mm.
And so it's not so much about like religious art exclusively. It's more about how, you know, faith is an important part of our lives and art is an important part of our lives. Sometimes they intersect but they're always there, and they're always informing each other.
Hmm.
And So that's what we're talking about there. And we're going to be interviewing different artists, different types of artists. But the launch date keeps getting pushed back. So unfortunately, I don't know when that would be happening.
All right. Well, keep me posted on that. Any social media you want to share?
Not at the moment. Thanks.
All right. Sounds good. Well, this was a pleasure. Ray, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you,
Seth. All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Ray. It's a really interesting book. And if you're a fan of Tim Power, certainly check this one out. As always, there are a number of ways to support the podcast. You can find all of that in the show notes, so I don't have to say it every time. And again, I want to thank everybody who does support the podcast in financial ways or just in kind of interacting with me on social media. I say this every now and then. If you've never reached out to me, feedback@hugospodcast.com. Find me on social media. I like to interact with folks. So if you're going to be in Worldcon in August in Seattle, I will be there as well. So if you're going to be there and you want to meet up, I would love to do that. I probably have the opportunity to get a fan table. I don't know. I'm a little nervous about doing that just because I'm afraid no one would show up. So let me know if you'd be interested in something like that or just an informal meetup. Just come and say hi one day. Okay. I think that's going to do it for this time. So thank you again, everybody, so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.